You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
Hey marketers, want a matchmaker to set you up with your perfect audience? Well, look no further. Get intimate right away with host-read sponsorships with Acast. Use Acast's self-serve ad platform to search and partner up with a podcaster or two from our network of more than 100,000 shows. Have them sing your praises in their own words. And get their listeners ready to be wooed into loyal customers. It's the ultimate loving endorsement. Book host-read sponsorships with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.
This is a podcast from ComediansComedian.com.
This is the Comedians Comedian Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the show. I'm Stuart Goldsmith, and remember to subscribe to this show on iTunes or wherever else you might be digging out your podcasts, because you're going to get a special free gift to subscribers only, in that I'm not going to leave it up on the RSS feed for long. At some point during December, remember to subscribe again for your little Christmas free gift. And remember also this week, last chance to come to Angel Comedy at the Bill Murray for Redacted on Thursday the 15th of December at the experimental late show time of 10:30 p.m. That's just for an hour, and it's a little experimental chat show, secret non-broadcast, non-podcast thing that I'm tinkering around with. So come along and see that. You can Google it for the details or just turn up. Remember to go to comedianscomedian.com/tour for all of the tour details for the show that compared to what that I'm taking around the place, all around the country in spring. And now let's get stuck into this episode. Brilliant conversation with someone who has been a long-term fan, I think it's fair to say fan of the podcast, certainly a long-term listener of the podcast, and as you'll hear, was way back 4 or 5 years ago when I mooted the idea of an open spot special, which I'm not doing. She was one of the most vociferous, bolshy, hey, you should definitely put me on this show people. So very good to have seen her work over the last couple of years and seen her sort of explode really into an incredibly passionate and outspoken comedian. Really good fun to talk to her. This is Fern Brady.
Thank you for coming on and climbing up all those stairs when you have a fractured ankle.
They don't know if it's fractured or if it's just my tendons, but it's a lot less painful than 2 weeks ago.
Okay.
So, yeah.
I'm just thinking the most recent episode where someone else had a leg injury or a foot injury was Liam Williams.
Yeah.
Who jumped out of a, or no, had climbed onto a window. Okay, so.
I didn't do anything as dramatic as his was quite.
Just tell us what you did to it.
I was rushing to meet Andrea Hubert and I fell over. A guy on a scooter rushed in front of me and I fell over. You know those scooters that are for children, but adults go on them?
Oh, scooter, like a
It was like a hit and run. Okay. Yeah, and then some people dragged, because I hit my head off the pavement, so then some people dragged me off the road, and I didn't want them to see me cry, so I got them to leave me alone. And someone put me in a chair outside Catford train station, and then I just cried in the rain for an hour with one shoe on. till my boyfriend's managed to get back from work. Because then Catford is just normal for a woman to be crying with dirt on her face, and it was really horrible.
Oh
but people
God.
Keep saying, oh, you'll get 20 minutes out of that. And no, I've not. So I feel like I've failed at comedy, that I don't have a hilarious bit on that yet.
That reminds me of it's almost the only joke of his that I remember, but I saw Johnny Vegas at the Fringe years ago with a beard, and he had a beard that year, and he said, one of his lines was, I'm such a failure as a comedian, I've grown a beard for a joke I haven't been able to write.
Yeah.
I just thought it was magic. Where to start? You, I think, we gigged together on the Russell Howard Stand Up Central thing. How was that experience for you?
Oh, I'm not even just saying this. That was a really great night because my friend, I'm really good friends with Johnny Pelham, and that was his first TV thing, and other things I've done, it's not like I've been on with my friends. And just everyone that was on was nice because you and Ed However, I've just forgotten his surname. Ed Campbell. Sorry, these are the painkillers I've been on. And Bridget Christie. Yeah, it was great. I was really happy that night. Because when I first did TV things, I thought everyone would be pals after and have a really great time. And it just doesn't happen. And then lots of people in TV are really thin, so they don't get drunk after. So I've got a really horrible memory after 8 out of 10 Cats where I was just sitting eating a cake and drinking and Carol Vorderman was talking about juice fasting somewhere nearby. And it just wasn't what I envisioned at all.
Okay. Where are you in your career at the moment? Because you've done bits and bobs of telly. You've done 2 hour shows, 3 hour shows?
Two hour, okay. Yeah. Well, it's quite weird. So the show I did this year, I thought was going to get really terrible reviews. And I had a lot of nightmares for like 3 months before doing it. And then it went really well. So yeah, nothing's gone the way I expected it because I got a TV thing before I had an agent. And at the time I was just doing a job. I was doing this weird job working with paedophiles and murderers. And then I got on Stuart Lee's thing. And then I had to go back to doing the night shift with the pedos right after I filmed Stuart Lee's thing. So
I'm not making any jokes there. There's no jokes about the BBC. There's like a film that's a wide open, like, you know, I was doing a...
It was like support... I wasn't doing BBC... No, pedos. Sorry, is it my accent?
No. I understand from what I know of you that you've worked it with mental health people. You've worked with stuff like
that. It was ex-offenders. I wasn't allowed to work with any of the sex offenders directly. I got a TV thing because Tommy from The Stand put me forward for it. Then I did 8 out of 10 Cats, and then I was working in a call centre like a month later, so it was really up and down. But then once I did my first 2 solo shows, things really got a lot better. And I had a BBC pilot that didn't get picked up here, but got optioned in America.
Did it?
Yeah.
This is Radges.
Yeah.
I watched that this morning. It's very funny. I will talk to you about that in a bit. I really liked it.
Thanks. Yeah, that's nice you said that, but I really was quite a control freak over it. Yeah, Radges, basically I got back from the Fringe last year and this woman emailed me and was like, hey, I'm the boss of Billy Crystal's company and we'd really like to talk about Radges. And I thought it was my mate Dave winding me up. So
it's quite a weird email to get, isn't it? Like, that's not... I've not heard many other comics going, no, have you got the Billy Crystal email yet?
Yeah, so that was weird. So they were thinking about doing something with it. But then when it didn't get made into a series here, despite very good iPlayer ratings, they didn't pick it up. But then they'd talked to CAA, which is Billy Crystal's agent, about it. So then BBC Worldwide heard about it. Then I get this woman phoning me who was like, greetings from LA. That's actually how they talked. And then they like gave me money to not do anything, to not have any involvement.
Okay, they bought the idea.
They've optioned it, and then I'll find out if it gets made into a pilot next year. That would be great if it did, because I could actually get a mortgage. But it was just good that it got options, because just having money meant I could preview my new show to death. Like, people say money doesn't matter, but it's really hard being skint in comedy.
Yeah.
So, right, so that happened. And then I did my show this year, did well at the Fringe. And then off the back of that, another American got in touch with me and was like, has anyone acquired the rights to your Fringe show and do you want to do an audio album? And there's this company called Comedy Dynamics. They made like loads and loads of people's audio albums in America. So I'm currently sort of tweaking my Fringe show a bit to record that early next year. But I'm going to record it here in the UK. Because for all I know, I could die on my arse in America. So I'm going to do one recording at McAuliffe Festival and one at The Stand in Edinburgh. So I hope that goes well. So, yeah.
And you're only a few years into your career. When did you do So You Think You're Funny? Like 2011?
Yeah, I've been going 6.5 years and I've been doing it professionally for 3 years. But it's really only been the last 2 years that I've not been sort of living month to month money-wise. Because I had to temp as a PA just to get ready for my first Fringe show. So this year was a lot easier because I just could focus on doing my show.
And what is it, do you think, that people are paying attention to? Like, the fact that people from LA have been in touch, and, you know, the kind of the TV opportunities that you've had, what qualities of your act do you think people are paying attention to?
I don't know, but I've started to think maybe I would do better in America than here, because, I mean, I feel like my accent and my class is only ever gonna hold me back here, and I'll only when you're Scottish and living in England, you'll always be defined as other. Like, I get described as Scottish comedian a lot, and I never grew up with a strong sense of Scottishness, so I'm a bit tired of it. I think people think I'm forthright or quite blunt or something, but I really didn't expect things to start going well here, because, like, I have an archive of bad Chortle reviews, so I just, yeah, the things that have happened in the last year, I've been not expecting them at all. But there's a definite type of person coming to my shows, which is really, I find really interesting. So, like, a lot of female comedians, like Louisa, will get a lot of girls and gay guys, I think, at her gigs. I get guys with beards who are into wrestling and computer games. It's so strange. It's just, and the girls that like me are very intense goth girls. So it's been really cool having the same people come back to my show this year. And my boyfriend was looking at my Twitter followers and he was like, wrestling, has a beard. Wrestling, works with computer games.
Do you know why that is? Do you know why that demographic is excited about you?
Yeah, I think they like those men, like women, where they get the feeling of fear confused with the feeling of love, because I'm quite aggressive on stage. I think that appeals to them. But it's been so consistent the last couple of years, that's the people coming to me.
But you're kind of getting, you're suggesting that you get kind of submissive people,
because you're so
dominant on stage.
Yeah, very. The men are submissive, and the girls that like me are quite intense girls, sort of quite intense, crazy girls. So maybe they see something in me that's like a kindred spirit or something.
I tell you what, I'm excited about you as a comedian is that, and I'm sure this is part of your. Not that my opinion means anything. I'm just saying it as like what I'm reading from.
Starstruck.
what I'm kind of reading from the outside. You don't give a fuck, and it's so refreshing. Is that not true?
I don't think that's true at all. A lot of people will say that I'm really honest, but I don't mean to be. And, like, I'm not very diplomatic, but I would like to be. I've been trying to practice that more. Because I remember Gav Webster saying to me early on, you have to just not give a shit about anything, but it takes ages to get like that. But it actually was only from doing solo shows and also living in London helped a lot. Because I started off in Manchester, and it's a smaller circuit, and I just really cared what other people thought about me. And then in London, it's so massive, it's a lot easier to just not care.
I get what you're saying. I'll just explain a bit more about what I...
Yeah.
I don't mean explain.
No, it's fine.
But let me talk around the subject a bit more. You are one of those comics who is very happy talking about the actual reality of your life. Like, a lot of comics, I think, talk about their lives, but they sort of isolate the nature of being a comedian, the nature of the industry, their likelihood of getting reviews, TV, stuff like that. They don't talk about the real stuff.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's like people talk about their real lives as it pertains to camping or a story about a wedding or, you know, so there's different,
yeah.
there's a spectrum of how much of the nitty gritty you get into. One of the kind of through lines of the show Male Comedian was about you not getting invited to female comedian's brunch.
Did you see the show?
Yeah.
So my solo show was about why I wasn't invited to this brunch, because I was really upset about
it. I remember seeing on Facebook how upset you were.
The people who organised the brunch weren't happy about it, right? Because it's a real brunch.
Sure.
But I've had other female comedians get in touch and say, I don't get invited to that brunch. So it's this is a hot topic amongst female comedians, who gets invited to the brunch or not. But I just thought it'd be funny to do a show about the feeling of being left out. Because initially I was like, I basically thought, what if I do the show about this? And people are like, what the fuck is she talking about? Like, I'm not being invited to a brunch. But then I was like, I think the show did well because people empathise with the feeling of being left out.
Yes, I definitely think that's true. And I think one of the, like, a really interesting thing you talk about in a very funny way, but like the subject is interesting and I've never heard any other comics talk about it, is when you do material about your inability to make friends with women. Or not your inability, you know, the difficulties you have.
Yeah.
I'm not singling that off, your absolute inability. No. But as you described, the problems you have making friends with women. Mm. I'm like, I've never heard another comic talk about that.
Yeah.
And that's a really kind of honest and sort of new seeming element of your life.
Yeah.
And I think that's a really good choice to talk about that. So talk to me about the decisions you make regarding what stuff you want to talk about.
Well, I remember a reviewer said my first show was more about what I wasn't than what I was. And at the time I was annoyed, but now I agree with them because my show this year was a lot more honest because I do find it, it's just that I'm quite socially awkward and I get quite nervous around girls. Like that Russell Howard thing, Bridget Christie asked if I wanted to go and see Jenna Friedman the next day and I got so nervous I like didn't reply initially. So I just do things like that.
Your difficulties forming friendships with women is obviously like a true part of your life, and we can talk about that. But I was also asking about the decision to put that stuff in the show as opposed to, like, you know, you've got more, I feel like you've got more kind of accessible clubby stuff. Like you've got stuff about your face and your eyes. You've got stuff about tall, you know, tall and
all
short.
All my boyfriends,
the tallie smallie thing, you know? But you also kind of like, that might be like the first half of the show, you also get into some really interesting topics.
Well, the way I wrote the show this year was, because when I think about what critics are going to say or what comedians are going to say, my brain shuts down and I can't write. So the only way I managed to write my show was by trying to second guess what other people were going to think. Like I did there was loads of stuff about how I used to be a stripper in my show this year. And that was like I'm actually hyperventilating. Basically, that was like a nightmare to preview because I was so worried what people were going to think about me or say about me when, because I didn't tell anyone for years when I was doing comedy, because why would you? I basically just had to put out of my mind what anyone was going to say about that. And then it turned out people were saying, oh, the stripping stuff was the most interesting. And I was like, yeah, but it's not got enough punchlines in it. I don't like doing serious bits in a show. I didn't want to do a bit about stripping where I was like, and in the end, isn't stripping empowering to women? Like, I didn't want to have a serious conclusion.
But I think you find serious stuff. Like, one of the things you talk about is that you were never the victim of abuse, but the reality of the situation is the woman that said the most bimbo thing would be made to dress as a tiny pumpkin.
Yeah, yeah.
You know what I mean? That's like
I have so many weird stories from stripping, and I'm hoping to get it into the American recording of the show. But it's so hard to practice that material at new material nights because you can't really do it in a 10-minute set. So if anyone has any advice on how to do that, please tweet me.
What are the difficulties that you're facing?
I don't feel I can go and do a 10-minute set about how I was a stripper somewhere because I found it so difficult to preview.
Why? What was difficult about it?
Because I thought people were glaring at me from the audience, but they weren't. Like, it was all imagined.
I think there is a really fascinating quality that you have whereby you are fearless and petrified at the same time.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, like, loads of people say that I look calm on stage, but I think it's just because I've got quite a blank facial expression. Because when I started comedy, I would shout a lot on stage, but it was just nerves. But when I was trying to preview the stripping material, I did a preview with Richard Gadd and there were loads of good comedians at it, like Finn Taylor and Matt Ewens and Finn's girlfriend Phoebe, who works in comedy. And Gadd's really hot sister was there and I started to think she was glaring at me. So I was like, well, you're all obviously here to see Richard Gadd, so I'm going to leave now. So there was a lot... loads and loads of previews are just flipped out, and it was only once I did the show and did about 10 shows at the Fringe that I managed to get that stripping material right.
Okay.
But there was a day where I got, like, I got a 5-star review early on at the Fringe, and the day I got a 5-star review, I, like, phoned. The review hadn't come out. This was the day the reviewer was in. I thought the show was terrible because it was a bad show. And I phoned my boyfriend and I was like crying in a cafe saying I had to go home. So it doesn't really make sense that the days, the worst days of the show were the days it got good reviews. And then Jay Richardson was in on a good day again and I got 3 stars off him again. So I've stopped reading reviews. I used to think, how do comedians not read their reviews? Like Carol Donnelly doesn't read his reviews, but I didn't have any problem. I still haven't read my reviews from this year.
Yeah. I haven't, and there's one or two of them kind of got sent to me, but I find it hugely, and I've said this on the show before, and I really enjoy saying it, and I want everyone to do the same thing. They're not for us. Don't read them. Isn't it brilliant when you don't read them? Because then you're just a person doing your job, being creative. You've got your career. It's great. You don't need to worry about what individuals think.
Yeah, yeah. So, yeah, I've got an awareness of what they were, but it was so much better not reading them.
So why do you think, having just said, you know, discharge
I'm quite
from
bad for not answering questions.
No, not at all. What I meant was, with me having just said, hey, let's not worry about reviews, I would like to talk about that thing. Why do you think a show that you thought was a really bad iteration of the show got a 5-star review? What was it that they saw in there that maybe wasn't... Is it like, might it be that they saw something in it that you weren't planning to present, or
it's just that thing of you have to be the most yourself that you can be in comedy, but that's easier said than done. And actually, the day I always get upset early on in the Fringe because it's just stressful, and the day that I was crying and wanting to go home, Felicity Ward like took me out for lunch and she was like, it's just because you have shame inside you, and if you have shame inside you, we're always going back to that place of shame. And I was like, you should be a therapist or something.
Yeah, this is so accurate. Yeah, okay.
So basically, because I was talking stuff that I was deeply ashamed about, that was why it was making me uncomfortable. But I was just imagining the audience were all glaring at me. But I mean, most people don't know what it's like to work in a strip club, so actually they find it interesting. But I still found any silences excruciating. I've forgotten the question again.
No, I think you've answered it. I think...
I think it was just because I was being the most myself.
So this is Fern. I'm so excited to think that she was someone who she's listened to the show a lot. And I think that's really great. I'm really pleased. It makes me feel like I'm contributing. We all know, don't we, that in my heart, all I want to be is Scott Blanks at the Classic in New Zealand. I just want to be Scott Blanks when I grow up. So the idea of having inspired anybody and helped anybody at all along their path in comedy is very exciting to me. So really, you've got to make an effort to see Fern. Go and see her. I'm sure she'll be at the Edinburgh Festival again next year. You can track her down all over the place online. But she really is a really exceptionally engaging and very, very funny comedian. As I said to her during this show, I was laughing out loud on the bus, and that doesn't happen all that often. So more from Fern in just a second. Apologies to those of you. So something weird happened with the Chris Gethard episode. issue? I'm a magazine now, apparently. Last episode of this podcast, 189, with the brilliant Chris Gethard. Highly recommend his work, and I think it was a good interview with him as well, so give that a listen. But if you are one of the people who download things and listen to them immediately, you will have noticed in the first couple of two or three days that the sound was very fractionally off, and there was a funny conversation on the Facebook group where someone was saying, is the sound tweaked? Are you both slower and deeper? And then someone else commented, I think they were just tired. It was mid-festival. I mean, we were undoubtedly tired, but also the sound had corrupted somehow. That is all now fixed, so you can get that episode from wherever you normally get your episodes of ComCom, and also the extras still available at comedianscomedian.com/extras. And those are all of the extras from the Dara O'Brien episode, the Russell Howard ones, the Alan Cochrane one, very firm favourite for a lot of people. So go to comedianscomedian.com/extras to download all of those by signing signing up to the mailing list and then batten down the hatches and prepare for a once-a-year bombardment of emails. You can get in touch with me, as you know, info@comedianscomedian.com or tweet me at ComComPod. The tour dates are now all in. I think they're all pretty much locked in, so you can come along and see the show. I'm really excited for you to come and see Compared to What, the show I took to Edinburgh just gone. I always feel like saying Edinburgh last year and then you get, what, 2015? No, this one, the most recent one. The comedy year, as you know, begins in September, fresh from the back of an Edinburgh show. I go, whoa, what? Oh, God, I've got to do it all over again. So on that basis, that's the show that I'm touring. And it's really good, man. There's some great stuff. Oh, man, that bit about school children with their ties, that's funny. I mean, there's lots of good bits. I'm struggling to... I just was about to give away a major revelation in the show, so I won't do that. I shan't bluster around the content anymore, but it's bloody good. So come along and see that. ComediansComedian.com/tour. The dates are all there. And while I'm just spruiking stuff, the first run of the new Soho Theatre shows is selling amazingly well. And I think I put on Facebook that it's half sold out, which is, you're right, whoever commented on that, it's a ludicrous phrase. But I at least received the first show report and went, Jesus, how many? So get in quick. It's on the 23rd of January and it's with Ellis James and John Robbins from there. And it's them as a double act entity that in their radio show they do on Radio X, and they podcast that as well, so check that out. There's probably time to become a oneer. You can certainly become a PCD by then. This is all, you know, their lexicon that I'm borrowing here, so get in touch and come and see. I don't mean get in touch, I'm just in a general spruiking mood. What I mean is get your tickets, come and see that, because they are selling out. Remember to subscribe for your special Christmas free gift dropping on the RSS feed at some point this December and not staying up there long. And also just subscribe anyway, because the next three episodes are absolutely cracking. Next week, I think we're going to go with the Brian Regan episode that I recorded in Montreal. That was properly like meeting Madonna. Very excited about that. Oh no, do you know what? We're not. I'm going to save that one for just after Christmas. Next week is going to be Pappy's. I'll tell you more about that. Pappy's return to the show. And holy God, that was a great live episode in front of some baying Pappy's fans. And I really, really enjoyed that. Chat to you more about that at the end. And then coming up, we've also got Joe DeRosa. Took that one, recorded that one in Edinburgh. Brilliant episode. As I said, Brian Regan is just such a wonderful comic. Such a lovely bloke. Huge. You won't necessarily know him if you're listening to the UK. He's not big over here, but he's colossal in the States and just tours and tours and tours, and with very good reason. And Angela Barnes also recorded a superb episode recently as well. So look out for that one coming up soon. That'll do us for now, I think. You know about it. I'll chat to you more after, okay? Here's more from Fern.
Whether you're a morning person or a bedtime procrastinator, everyone deserves a mattress that works for their style. And you'll find the best mattress for you at Ashley. The new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley brings you one-of-a-kind body-conforming technology, making every sleep tailored to be your best. The collection also features cool-to-the-touch covers and motion absorption to help minimize sleep disruptions from partners, pets, or kids. Shop the all-new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
I found with the show that I'm writing at the moment for next year, there's a couple of moments where I feel like there's a change in what I'm writing, what I'm doing, because like I'm talking about Brexit, never written anything political ever in my life, and I'm at one point, I say, look, I haven't done the reading and fuck off, neither of you. And that gets quite a nice laugh. And then it allows me to kind of reveal that I'm talking about my emotions about it rather than talking about the research and the facts and figures and the Article 50s and all the rest of it. And I'm finding that that is hugely liberating for me because I feel like I can talk about how I actually feel. Whereas previously I've been very, I've felt very in a cage because I'm like, I don't want to risk saying something that reveals I'm stupid. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, that
sort of thing.
Yeah.
And I think,
but most audiences don't know either.
Well, but yeah, like, you might be right. I only mention that because I think when I watch your stuff, and I was laughing out loud on the bus, listening to that, you sent me like your previous year's show, and I listened to that, I genuinely laughed out loud 5 or 6 times on the bus. I was chuffing like myself. No. I mean, it's great. And part of that laughter was the sort of joy at how liberated you are talking about what you actually think and what you actually feel.
Yeah, I just thought it would be good to keep But I think solo shows have really helped me because for ages I wanted to be a circuit stand-up because I feel like in London there's a lot of distaste for circuit comedy, but all the comics I like Paul Sinha and Dave Jones and just sort of traditional like jonglers-y type stuff. I feel like that's just dismissed in London. But anyway, I did jonglers for a bit and weekendy gigs. And I thought that would make me better, but then I did solo shows and I was like, no, I think I just want to focus on solo shows. Maybe there's a way of doing both, but...
Yeah, yeah, I don't know, because before you can make all of your money from doing solo shows,
yeah,
you've got to pay the rent. And I think club gigs pay the rent. And I think some club gigs do make you better. And some club gigs don't matter, and some club gigs make you worse.
But yeah, I'd like to be sort of somewhere between the alternative and the mainstream circuits. I feel like there's a big divide between the two. Especially in London, there seems to be like a very alternative circuit, and then...
Yeah.
Do you not think?
Yeah, I think so. I think there's... like, I naively thought of myself as an alternative comedian when I started.
Yeah.
Before realising that, I suppose I'm quite mainstream. That wasn't part of the plan.
Yeah.
But then if you look at some of the... Like, we've mentioned Matt Ewins a couple of times.
Yeah,
look at what
he
does. I mean, that is so fucking alternative.
Yeah.
You know, or the weirdos or, you know, the amount of really straight... You know, Tajay... You know, all the weird stuff out there. Yeah. Do you see yourself more as mainstream or alternative? Where are you at the moment?
More mainstream. But then I feel too weird on the alternative circuit. I don't know. Like, I would never have... If I'd have stayed in Scotland, because I moved to England like 4 months into doing stand-up.
And why did you move? Was that for work, stand-up?
No, I'd graduated uni and I was going to do a postgrad in Sheffield to train as a journalist. But I knew I wanted to do comedy and I knew there wasn't much of a scene in Scotland. Or I'd heard Manchester and London were the places to go. So I moved to Manchester after quitting my postgrad. Sorry, I've forgotten the quit. I've been on these painkillers that have
totally,
just destroyed
totally
my memory.
Fine. It's also a conversation. We don't need to be rude. It doesn't
I'm
have
so
to be
gutted.
Strictly Q&A.
Well, I'm just so annoyed that I went off. I mean, I really have rehearsed answers carefully while listening to this podcast.
That's cool, because I don't want to hear your rehearsed answers.
That's
occasionally happening now when I interview people, because it's been going for a few years.
Yeah,
I interview people who've listened to a lot of them. I have to kind of go, I have to ask you different stuff so I don't get your preferred stuff.
So if I'd have done comedy in Scotland and stayed there, I can't imagine... I mean, there's hardly any women on the bills still. The Scottish and Irish scenes, I find, is still really male-dominated, whereas down here, there's so many women doing it. And also, yeah, it's just so different. I go back to Scotland pretty much once a month, and I love gigging there, but I mainly do the stands, like, when I do other gigs. Because down here, a lot of people think I'm Glaswegian and think I'm really working class. So there's a notion that Scottish people are really aggressive and stuff. And that works in my favour down here. But like, I was playing a snooker club in Glasgow the other week. And they know I'm not Glaswegian. Like, they know what I am.
Okay.
And I can't get away with trying to be hard. Like, they know what I am.
I'm really interested in that, the kind of... What are you?
Well, like, I went to a good uni. I went to Edinburgh and, like, I had piano lessons from the age of 5. And, like, my boyfriend's always saying, oh, you lionise your working class identity. But then you're saying how your mum took you to all these extracurricular things, which is quite middle class. And I had I ate in quite a hippie-ish way. So neither of my parents went to uni, but culturally I had quite a nice... upbringing, I think, in terms of all the piano lessons and stuff.
And in London, you can either disguise that or that can be a revelation. You can kind of play the dynamic between what we think we know about you.
Yeah, it's
and the truth.
I'm having quite a hard time with the things people think about my class here. Like, I was talking to my dad about this the other day. I did my solo show in Brasserie Zadel recently, which is this unbelievably posh play some Piccadilly Circus, and they had a piano on stage, so I was lying on the piano, and then I started playing on it, and people were laughing. And I said to my dad, like, I realised they're laughing because someone with this accent is playing, like, a Mozart sonata.
Okay.
And then I was just pissed off thinking about that. Like, it just really... Cause
on stage, or you realised that afterwards?
No, I just realised it the other day talking to my dad. I'm just sick of the stuff. Like, I was saying to someone, I had a meeting with someone at the Fringe, and I said, oh, my mum's moving house, because she lives in a house now where all the neighbours look down into the garden. And he was like, a high-rise flat. And I was like, no, I'm not from a high-rise flat. And then I had a meeting at the BBC this year where they wanted me to host a documentary in a women's prison in Scotland, because I wrote a Guardian article about how I got in trouble for fighting when I was 18, which to the media classes makes me Al Capone. And they were like, this posh guy I had the meeting with was like, so as I understand it, you were in a women's prison. I'm like, no, I fucking wasn't in women's prison. Like, what do you think about me? I mean, I thought about doing next year's show about that kind of thing. It really winds me up.
Is there something a bit contradictory about your choices with kind of the media? Like, you've written these pieces for The Guardian.
Yeah, and by the way, that's how I got everything in comedy. It wasn't from, like, gigging a lot on the circuit. Every opportunity I got in comedy was from writing not funny articles in The Guardian, because posh people who work in telly read The Guardian. It's just insane how everything I got was from that.
But at the same time, I mean, you sound quite sort of dismissive of that, but they are intelligent, impassioned, well-written pieces.
Oh,
why shouldn't
thanks.
You?
Get- and crucially, you can't hear my accent.
Yeah, right.
Because my voice, I sound like an idiot when I talk, but then I'm telling you, that's how I got everything, because you can't hear my accent. And there's definitely, because the media is so dominated by RP accents, I mean, even to get into journalism school, I was on a diversity scholarship.
Right.
Because it's so dominated by privately educated people. So, yeah, that's honestly how I got everything. And that pisses me off, but at the same time, I'm glad I did that. Because I was really floundering at the time I was writing those Guardian articles. I really wasn't getting anywhere.
And you... Just something that occurs to me is, at least in the first one, I can't remember if this is true of all of them, but you were answering comments. You were in the comment section, like, as yourself, replying to people's comments.
My first article.
I think it was the first one.
The first one was just about having a criminal record, which was quite a big gamble. No, it wasn't. It was in the... Everything I've written is just for the Guardian comment section, but it wasn't responding to a comment.
I mean, you as Film Radio were posting, you were replying to people's comments.
Oh, you really researched this.
Yeah, well, that caught my eye, because I've never seen anyone do that before.
It's because, like, they encourage
that,
you.
That is in... Oh, okay, all right. I was thinking that is very Fern to go, right, there's the piece. I'm standing in the comment section. Bring it on.
No. It's because the editor encourages you to do that. I mean, and because it was my first time, I was like, oh, I'd better do this. But then after that, I didn't want to do it. Because I don't like reading the comments.
No.
I'd like to go back to the old days of journalism where people have no say online.
So you're writing these pieces, and you... I mean, do you feel... I don't know if dismissive is the right word, but, like, how do you feel about the fact that writing those pieces kind of gave you a way into comedy? Do you feel like that was an unfair advantage? Are you proud of it? I feel like you should be proud of them. They're good
pieces. Really glad I did it. And I think it taught me that you have to be proactive, because prior to that, I think there's a problem in comedy with people saying, why hasn't stuff happened for me? And it's like, well, you have to keep making stuff and putting things out there. Because I really was getting nothing at all. Like, at the time of writing those Guardian things, I was on the dole. And I was doing a 0 hours contract with, like, working with the murderers and stuff. And Steve Bennett and Bruce Dessau had just given me horrible, horrible reviews. So I wasn't getting booked. And then, yeah, I'm so glad I wrote those Guardian things. Because then off the back of that, a sequence of events happened where Tommy Shepherd put me forward for Stuart Lee's thing. And then during the, when Stuart Lee interviewed me for that programme, he mentioned the Guardian articles. And I was like, that's so mad that everything has happened. Yeah. Everything happened just from writing them.
And that's a real kind of, that's your indie credentials for a good few years, isn't it? If you've done that Stuart Lee show.
I don't know. It was a shame because the second series, I don't think many people watched it because the Comedy Central just put it on really late. But yeah, it was a good thing to do. Also, when I did that, I didn't realise how great it was that they didn't control what you were saying at all. Because then I did stand up on another show where you had to like submit a script word for word to what you were going to say, and the producers were just at you. So yeah, it's really good how he just let you do what you want.
So in your first show, you talked about ending up being interviewed by Christian Guru Murthy.
Oh, God, that was absurd.
Okay, tell me how absurd it was, because I've got a question about how absurd it was. You certainly present it in your show as these people rang me up and asked me to come on and talk about this stuff, and I'm totally unqualified to talk about Scottish independence.
Yeah, so on the Monday of that week, I was on with 10 Cats, and then on the Friday, my agent at the time phoned up and was like, Channel 4 News wants someone to go on and talk about Scottish independence. And I sort of pro-independence, but not in a way that I know anything about it at all. Like Johnny Pelham said that my views on politics are like a child's views. And my boyfriend works in politics. And like I got asked to go on Question Time and he was begging me not to because he just knew it was going to be a disaster. So my agent told me, if you go on the news to talk about Scottish independence, you will be able to get on 8 out of 10 Cats again. Something I now know to be a ridiculous lie. But I thought it was true. So I agreed to it. And then I was sitting in front of Krishnan and Guru Murthy and the whole thing just felt very real. Once you're in the news studio, and my agent was like, oh, you should wear a nice dress. But they didn't give me time for that. So then I was just wearing the jumper that I'd been wearing to clean in the house. And it was just absurd. And I'd phoned my mate, Ellen. There's a comedian, Eleanor Morton, who is so into Scottish independence. And she wears like little SNP badges. And so she told me a couple of things to say. So I just went on, parroted what she'd said. Then I just made stuff up and I said, oh, the English are all colonising us and stuff. And then I just thought, I just didn't think anything would happen. Then I was out that night with some comedians and then my Twitter just started going mad with people saying, I hope this bitch gets deported. And then SNP people being like, she is a hero of independence. And I got annoyed because I didn't want either side claiming me. So I did it. So in my show, I was just like, I don't give a shit about either of those things. I just want to be famous. I care more about being on TV than any political thing.
That is... Okay, so there's a whole...
Because it annoys me how much comedians want to be taken seriously now. There's a thing where comedians all want to be taken seriously politically. And then Ed Balls is on Strictly Come Dancing and... And then Nick Clegg mimed a Carly Rae Jepsen thing for a music video. It's all back to front, and I don't really like it.
So my question was going to be, when you talk about it in the show, you're like, they rang me up and asked me to be on TV. They presumably rang you up in the context of, you've written articles for The Guardian.
Yeah.
You are you have established yourself as a cultural commentator.
It was because I was on Cats that week and I was Scottish and I lived in London.
You'd written a Guardian article. So you're like,
I hadn't written anything about Scottish independence in my life.
Okay, I see what you mean. Yeah.
Yeah, no. This was the only reason they asked me was I was Scottish and I'd been on TV that week. Okay. So,
and you said yes.
I said yes because they were giving me money.
Okay, yeah, you did refer to that. I was going to ask if that was true. So that you were paid to do a news interview.
Yeah, yeah, that was the only reason I did it.
Okay.
So that was what I was trying to make clear in my show. I still have, like, Scottish journalists who are in favour of independence I think, given me good reviews because they saw that Channel 4 News thing, and I just get annoyed and I want to just destroy it and be like, no, you can't.
That is fascinating. What a weird journey through that kind of thing.
Yeah.
I mean, you've ended up, I guess, you've been quite deft in how you've then decided to nip that in the bud by going, here we go. And that's a very funny angle to take with it, as well as, I don't care about this important, the thing that's important to you. I don't care about this important thing that's important to you. I just want to be famous.
Yeah.
It kind of wipes the slate clean very effectively.
Yeah, I just don't want to be a comedian that is like a professional opinion giver, because I've turned down a lot of those kind of things. Like, well, to be fair, the Question Time thing was more of a me failing the vetting process. But, and also my boyfriend was like, just please, please don't go on it.
Okay.
But yeah,
what
I went...
What do you think would have happened if you had gone on?
Oh, God, it would have been a disaster. Like...
Eleanor.
Yeah.
Get an earpiece.
I do a political topical show in Scotland called Breaking the News, and I have had to ask my boyfriend to explain things to me before.
That's interesting that you, and this is sort of tangential, but you are educated, and you are, you know, you've got.
But if I'm not interested in a topic, my brain doesn't cling on to it. So like, I'm really interested in Scientology and I read a lot about that, or I'm interested in like LGBT stuff and I'll read a lot about that, but I had to write jokes on Trident for Breaking the News, and God, that was dreadful.
Hence the Little Mermaid bit, presumably.
Yeah,
so that was
that the only reason that got written. I really love doing this Breaking the News show because I have to write jokes on stuff I would never write about.
So it's almost like in a kind of way you have accidentally pitched yourself as a person who's a topical comedian.
Yeah,
and as a result, you're having to learn how to be a political comedian.
Yeah,
and you're learning
how to
field those things. And that kind of works. Like what we were saying before about the agency that you have to just go your own way on a topic. Like you don't have to be Mark Steele going, right, I've done all the reading, here's what I think.
Yeah.
Actually, you can do a Little Mermaid joke, and if it's funny enough, you're allowed to be there.
Yeah, honestly, like, writing for that, because the money's not very good, although I do hope they continue to book me. But
I love when people say stuff like that. Totally get where you're coming from.
I've never worked so hard for anything. Every episode of that show, I'll write for 9 hours the day before. And because the topics are so dry, it forces your brain to get creative. So I just try and make sure I have something to say for every topic. I never thought I would enjoy panel shows, because I've done a lot of panel show auditions, but it's just really good because you have to be creative.
Okay, so let's talk about that creative process as it pertains to something like Breaking the News or a panel show. They give you the package of like, this is the stuff, these are the things we're going to hit. What's your first approach? What are your first steps on being given a really dry topic?
This is my thing that I always do, and I'm slightly embarrassed to say it because now I'm worried if anyone listens to this and then listens to my stuff, they'll see that I do it.
Okay.
If there's a topic I know nothing about at all, I just turn it to, I twist it so I can say something about something weird that happened to me. So the way I got on 8 out of 10 Cats, because I was the last person that anyone would have expected to get on that. The audition was all like Avalon and Off the Curb acts and just the kind of people you would think would be at that audition. And I didn't know how I'd got the audition for it. And then one of the topics was like, oh, footballers are getting paid loads and loads these days. And I was like, I have nothing to say on that. And I don't remember the exact line, but I said, oh, I used to get paid loads. And I talked about, like, one time when I was a stripper, Colonel Gaddafi's nephews were in the club and, like, offered me all this money to dance for them. And the audition for Cats is in front of all these Endemol staff, and they all just started laughing. And that was basically what got me on, because they just thought, I think they thought I was just making stuff up or something.
Or, I mean, either that, or they kind of recognised that you presumably no one else was taking that approach. Do you know what I mean? Like, yeah, like they, you're an asset to a panel show.
I think, well, I met a guy that writes for it, a girl I'm friends with, her boyfriend writes on it, and he said, all they're looking for in panel shows is for you to have a distinctive persona from the off. And actually, it helped that I'd never done an audition for one before, because see, after that, once I knew how much money you got for them and what was at stake, I've had a ton of auditions for them since, and I do the classic mistake of, this is what they must want from me at a panel show audition, and then I just mess it up. Like, the best ones I have are where I can be completely myself. But it's easier said than done, to be honest.
I think that's really smart. I 100% agree with that, and I think it's also really interesting that you're aware of that, but you can't necessarily overcome that at this stage.
No.
Like, I know exactly what you mean. They want a distinctive person. I think very often when you see someone on a panel show, as an audience member, you go, oh, of course they're doing panel shows. Of course they're, yeah, of course they're part of the new raft of people who are now going to start getting all the panel shows.
Yeah.
You kind of go, oh, yeah, because there isn't one of them. There isn't a person with that angle, with that background.
Mm.
You go, yeah, that makes perfect sense. That realizing that is a really important part of the puzzle. But at the same time, that doesn't necessarily means suddenly you are able to fulfill that role.
Yeah, there is a place for weirdos, though, as long as you're, I mean, like, if you look at Joe Wilkinson, he's weird, and James Acaster has a really distinctive persona, and so yeah, I think there's a place for weirdos. But I'd like to do more panel shows just to get more people to come and see my shows. I still think being a female comedian, you have to be thin and pretty, but I don't know, because then I'm like, I have done a few things looking the way I look, so maybe there's nothing to worry about.
Tell me if this is territory that we shouldn't go into, but you're pretty thin and you're quite, you're quite pretty.
Oh, thank you.
No, do you know what I mean? Like, I feel that obviously this is a different...
Sorry, I thought this you were going to be like, Farron, why don't you just stop eating bread?
Okay, eggy territory, but you see, the point I'm making, you are a fairly thin, attractive young woman. And...
Yeah, in Scotland I'm thin, but...
But like, because I read the Guardian piece that you wrote about, if you want to get on TV as a woman, yeah, you need to be posh or pretty.
But I mean, how can I say that now? Because I've been on stuff.
Well.
So I can't, I mean, I can't, and I can't complain. I complain a lot about privileged people getting ahead, but I can't really complain about that.
I think it's, I don't know, I think you can still complain about it even, and I think you
well,
have done
a lot
in the past.
Of people,
you can still complain about something that benefits you, because there's an awful lot of people who are prepared
but
to
I'm
not mention it.
Loads of people are subsidised by their parents in comedy. Because for ages I was like, how am I on telly and I'm still skint and stuff? And then you find out loads of people, like, their parents are just fucking paying their rent and they're not... Or a lot of London comedians still have to live with their parents. So that was when I was like, oh, I'm doing all right. Anyway, about the thinness, that I think... Because the first time I seen myself on something, I was like, why did no one tell me I was fat? And then obviously I got tweeted with people saying... like, about my weird face and that. But, so I think it's just once you see yourself on stage.
I have to believe that you can be removed from... Because what you've just described seems
no,
to me
watch
like
myself
someone
on
with
stuff.
Perhaps low self-esteem to do with their body image.
Yeah.
Then reading the fucking comments. Like, that. Those two things, neither of those two things are a representation of reality.
Yeah.
And I'm listening to your material about it, your hammerhead shark stuff, all the rest of it.
Yeah.
Thinking, you know, you... This has to be material, like, you can't believe the stuff that you're saying.
No, I do believe it. Like, no, I do. Me and my boyfriend have this ongoing thing where I've said, look, I need to get... Because I broke my nose a few years ago. I'm very accident prone. I opened a door into my face. And then once I started seeing myself on programmes, I was like, oh, shit, I need to get a nose job.
What?
Yeah, but a couple of people have said I've got that body dysmorphia thing, but I think I've just got eyesight and a good sense of what a symmetrical face.
I think that's what body dysmorphia feels like.
No, I think I know what symmetry is. So So, but yeah, my boyfriend was like, if you get a nose job, that will be, your vanity has gone too far, and I will punch your nose sideways when you come back from it. But yeah, see, this is what I hate about, obviously, stripping. I didn't mean to mention stripping so much. Since doing the show about it, because I didn't talk about it for years, now it's all I want to talk about.
Sure.
But stripping was so, everything was so focused on looks. And then when I went into comedy, I could dress really boyishly, and I was like, this is great because everything's focused on what you say. And then I got really annoyed once I started trying to get bits of TV, because you're like, oh, I'm just back to being judged for how I look. And it's quite frustrating to... Because I just want to be a comedian. I don't want to act in anything or that. But I do feel like getting ahead in comedy will be heavily based on how I look.
Okay.
You do get... I mean, female comedians do get told to lose weight for stuff. I think it happens with male comedians as well, because if you look at old pictures of Russell Howard, like, I think he works out a lot now, and...
I think
Joe Lycett lost weight and looks incredible. And
yeah, I mean, I wouldn't like to hazard a guess as to why people are doing that. I know that, like, Russell Howard is a big fan of exercise.
Yeah.
I don't know about Joe's personal sort of thing.
Oh, none of this is, these are all like, these are all like the comedians that I think of as my, for inspiration when I go running,
sure,
and stuff.
Sure, sure. Yeah, right. Okay. Like, yeah, God, that, maybe I should start doing either of those things.
I notice a lot of comedians, once they start getting on more stuff, they drop weight. So I think it's quite a common thing for people
I wonder how much they are having pressure applied to them by the industry, and how much, I mean, my take on that has always been that here are my assumptions, which I don't know whether these are valid or not. I can imagine, and I've heard a lot from female comics that I've had on the show and that I've talked to, that they have pressure applied on them gently and insidiously lose weight, you know, look, tell people they're younger than they are, stuff like that.
Yeah, that happened to me.
Yeah. Right. I mean, I've been told that, it has been suggested to me by a high up industry person that I dye my hair. Because I've got very grey,
young, though.
Oh, thank you. Well, I think their angle was, you look so young, why don't you dye your hair? Because it's giving the game away, you know. But I certainly wasn't, no pressure was put on me. But I've always assumed when male comics lose weight, it's because they've gone, hey, I can get chicks now because I'm funny, and that they've wanted to, rather than because people, shadowy TV execs, have been saying, you've got to look
more. I thought they did it for TV, but yeah, it definitely happens with women. We're, much as feminism's so zeitgeisty now, we're still very much living in an age where women are valued on how much they can look young and how they can look beautiful and stuff. And I think people just don't talk about it. They just pretend it doesn't exist.
Why do you think people don't talk about it? Why do you think women, female comics, don't talk about it so much? Like, in the way that you do a lot. You're one of a fairly small group of women
realize.
That you go, oh, Fern will speak her mind.
Maybe they don't realise, but I mean, Joan Rivers has a saying that no female comedian was pretty as a child, which I think is really true. So I think once you know the pain of being an ugly, mustachioed, specky child, like, you know that you're not valued for your looks. That's why a lot of female comedians were ugly children, and it means you have to be funny at school to compensate.
Okay.
But
there's reservation in my voice, because I'm just thinking that does that not play into an idea that comedy is what do you think of that? The idea that there are more male comedians because comedy is more of a transactional thing for men. Whereas growing up, we socialise by mocking each other, whereas women tend to be more supportive. I feel like that... I mean, I think I've said that in the past. I've certainly thought that in the past. I wonder if that's too broader.
I think it's also women are socialised to be submissive. I don't know. I forgot what I was going to say again.
I suppose you're...
I emailed Katz the other week because I don't have an agent. This is where I need an agent.
Okay. Oh, you, like, you don't currently have an agent? Okay.
No. And I was like, I have had offers, but I don't want to go with one for the sake of it. So I emailed Katz and I was like, hey guys, I've lost 10 pounds since I was last on. Can you let me back on? And I was...
Did you get a reply?
Yeah, I did get a reply. And they were like, yes, we will consider putting you back on. But I don't know if they were just... But then they were like, who's your agent? And I was like, guys, can you just email me? But I told my friend that, another comic, and she was like, you're mental case. Why did you do that?
Well, I think that is... Why did you do that?
Well, because... Tom Allen was telling me he got himself on a few things and I found it really inspiring, but I would imagine Tom Allen would do it in a normal, sane way rather than a lunatic email like saying that you've lost weight.
But I guess you could say that you did it in a very Fern Brady way, and coming back to what we were talking about before.
Yeah, I don't really think
about
of it in that way.
Being an individual voice. Like, I can't think of many other people who would send an email like that. Maybe that's really would work for you because that's very typical of what you're bringing to the table.
Yeah, I mean, well, I invited industry people to come to my show this year and they did come along. So I did sort of start thinking, because I haven't had a comedy... I've got a writing agent because I needed one for the American thing, but I haven't had a comedy agent for over a year now and I got a lot more work after I left. But that wasn't because I left them. It was because I'd done my solo shows. So... Yeah, I've become a lot more proactive and realised how much work you get on your own. But at the same time, I do need an agent now because I've done things like sign contracts without reading them. And I got asked to do a corporate. I got asked to do a couple of corporates for the first time this year. And I didn't want them to know I'd never done them before. I shouldn't say that on the podcast. So I said this outrageously high fee. And then I was telling an agent that I had a meeting with and he was like, that's what Hal Crunden would charge. Like, you're an idiot.
Yeah. But and you didn't get the gig. I thought I was going...
No,
hoping
I did not get the gig.
I was hoping the story would be that you get the gig. So no. To any agents listening, Fern Brady is available for representation chats. And to any people that want to exploit her because she signs contracts without reading them, you should also fill your boots.
Yeah. Basically, I think I need an agent for that. And you just spend so much time doing admin rather than writing jokes. I'd imagine... I don't know, but do you find having an agent you do less admin?
Oh, I don't think so. I really believe in my management, but I do a lot of... I mean, I've got the podcast as well, so I do tons of it.
Yeah. So I hope I get a comedy agent soon, because I don't think I can continue in this manner.
Let's bring it back to something that is a central tenet of... What you...
I'm sorry, I just remembered something funny.
Go on.
Well, so this American recording, I'm so excited about it, but I'm so freaking out having to do it on my own. And they're like paying for the photos and the recording and all that. But they were like, oh, is there anything you want in the photo shoot? And I really want two live wolves, but I'm too embarrassed to tell them that. So I'm delaying it, and I know there's going to have to be a point where I'm like, can you budget for wolves in the picture? So I think if I had an agent, maybe they could cross that. Like,
yeah, okay. You need a wolf budget, a wolf rider.
Well,
you've got to have someone negotiate your one.
I'm just too embarrassed to ask.
So I want to bring it back to something that I think is a central facet of you, which is anger.
Yeah.
You talked in your shows a little bit before about your anger, about an incident you had where you attacked someone.
Oh, well, in the first show, that wasn't something I got in trouble for. I kicked a man outside a KFC.
I think I'm confusing it then with...
You're confusing it with a Guardian article.
With the Guardian article.
Yeah, I would never do comedy on that, like... I think that would be quite insensitive.
Okay, which was... I mean, do you want to talk about that? Are you... Or
I'd
are you
got in trouble. I had a fight when I was 18 and I got fined for it in court, which is terrible. But not terrible that I got, but I completely agree and stuff. But no, I didn't do any comedy on it.
To what extent does anger motivate you and your comedy?
Oh, loads.
Good.
And loads.
Fine. I did my. Yeah. That was the assumption I was making. Yeah. I didn't want to just be too.
I got into comedy because a guy I went out with who was horrible took me to see Brendan Burns, and I was like, oh, I want to do that. And then he was like, oh, it's not as easy as it looks. So I'll use things like that to motivate me. I use a lot of negative thoughts to motivate me. Although saying that, I started meditating. This is really wanky, but I started meditating loads for like my most recent show and my first show. And that helps a lot. Because I think I did stuff on meditation in my first show. It's quite a popular thing with comedians.
Okay. But let's just talk about this idea of anger as a motivating factor. I think that I remember that Hal Cruttendon talked about that. And a couple of other people come to mind, but it's certainly a minority of people who are like, I mean, would you say that you have a problem with anger?
Not anymore, because like I said, I did meditating and I went to some counselling, but I've been thinking about getting more help with it. It's more like, I have a problem containing my frustration and anxiety. Like, I get so angry at ridiculous things on trains, like people playing their music openly on trains. But I wouldn't say I'm as bad now because I do meditation and I drink matcha tea, which makes you really calm as well. I sound like a total hippie.
And you're also very strong painkillers at the moment.
Yeah, I'm in the withdrawal for them now, but they've totally affected my memory. Like, I text my mum the other night to ask where she was gigging. she was like, what? So that's how much they've affected me.
I find in the past when I've had bad gigs sometimes, it's because, or like my instinct has been that this is because of fear, because I've been wrapped up in being scared of them. I've been wrapped up in like what stopped me getting into my best performative state as a comic is some kind of anxiety or fear that I'm not gonna give them what they want or something like that. That's like, for me, I would say fear is probably a motivating factor. Are there kind of equivalents with anger? Do you, when you've had some good gigs, when you've bombed somewhere, do you fall back to a place of being angry with them?
No, what I was going to say is I really love to be... Oh, this is going to sound so weird. This isn't as much of a thing. If you're in a green room with me, don't... Like, this isn't as much of a thing anymore. So if... I love if people, like, are rude to me backstage and make me feel really angry and bad inside, because I find it a lot easier to have a good gig. Like, it's so good to feel bad inside for comedy, but then that can be a trap because you want to have a happy life and stuff. And when we did Russell Howard, actually, I was worried because I was having such a nice time that I was like, oh, this is ruining it because I feel too happy inside.
Okay.
So, yeah, I had to really concentrate on feeling bad. And then what helped was I walked out into the audience and I saw women look disgusted at me. So I focused on that hatred of them. So it's quite a weird way of doing it.
It's kind of like you're a Sith.
Oh, I've not seen those films. Okay. I mean, sorry. That's
probably the first and probably the last Star Wars reference. But the idea being that you are kind of using negativity as a force rather than positivity as a force, but you're using it in a very positive, creative way. If you have a better gig, if you feel more, if the gig, does the gig feel more cathartic?
So
like, if you're funnier when you're angry or when you're feeling bad, when that sentence you just said
it's not so much
inside.
Angry, it's I get just a really bad feeling inside and I feel really bad about myself, and that's a really great time to gig. Because you just feel so, like I got into comedy after a really humiliating breakup, so I felt very low. I think this is quite common, actually, for people to get into it. I remember on the Sarah Pascoe one, she said she'd just had a breakup, And I think it's just because you just feel so much shame about yourself that you can't get any lower, so you're willing to humiliate yourself more.
And you did mention that like that's less so now, and also you're aware it's problematic because you want to have a happy life. Like, yeah. Can you imagine yourself 10 years from now about to play some massive gig somewhere and
no.
life's going great and you're having to be backstage working yourself up into some sort of position of self-loathing in order to... I mean, does that feel like a long-term strategy?
I don't know, because, I mean, I'm very happy with my boyfriend and stuff, and I have quite a contented home life, but I still have good gigs. I've got so many layers of, mental illness that luckily I can draw on that for years to come, like a well.
Okay.
But... I think a lot of people are trying to find happiness from comedy that they won't ever find. And I used to think I have quite a... Because if you have mental health problems, you really should try and stay quite even. So when we did Russell Howard, I felt euphoric. And then the next day, I got a crushing low. And that's quite a common thing. That happens to me a lot.
Yeah. Like,
the first time it happened was the So You Think You're Funny final. And... So, yeah, I think you have to be quite careful with that. And that's how meditation helps, because, even when I was getting good reviews at the Fringe, I was kept meditating because you have to just think that it doesn't matter. That sounds really wanky, but loads of comedians that I like meditate.
Yeah. I've experienced something similar myself. I had a listener to this show, I described it on the show once, and a listener emailed and said, oh, that's a peak experience, which you can look up on Wikipedia. But that's a thing identified by a psychoanalyst, I think, called Arthur Maslow, which is like a sort of giddy sense of super connectedness to the world where you sort of find yourself crying for joy in your car. That's how I have moments. And I would often, I would have those from time to time.
Yeah.
And then they would often be followed by a real sort of depressive lurch.
Yeah.
And I remember thinking at the time, I don't want to have to nip those in the bud, because they're enjoyable when they happen. You're like, oh, this is so great.
Yeah.
But there's a certain school of thought, I guess, that says you've got to measure them a bit more. You've got to kind of suppress them a little bit so that you stay a bit more level.
Yeah, absolutely. It's why so many comedians get depressed after the Fringe. Like, loads of my friends are really down in September. And even Scott Gibson won Best Newcomer this year, and he was saying he was quite low after.
Yeah, it's anticlimactic.
Yeah,
I guess seen through the prism of mental health, that when the highs are so high.
Yeah. You have to be quite... careful of that. My boyfriend always says I'm a nightmare when I come back from the Fringe, because I come back expecting to be showered with compliments, and he just wants me wash the dishes. So yeah, that's I think comedy's brought out my very worst narcissistic tendencies, because to be a good comedian you kind of have to be a good narcissist, I think, to some extent.
Why do you say that?
Well, narcissists are... they're bad, but they're also charming and charismatic and talk about themselves. Like most comedians fit that profile. And when I went into comedy, I was actually quite shy. I find being in big groups quite difficult. And then through comedy, I feel like I've become... It draws out this monster in you, almost.
Okay.
Because I met someone that I knew from before comedy, came to my show in Bristol the other week, and I was just thinking, oh God, I'm just such a egomaniac now. Whereas at least before there was some sort of veneer of normalness.
It's certainly, if you are a narcissistic personality, I think comedy certainly rewards that.
Yeah, exactly.
And it kind of encourages you to do it more.
Yeah, you're totally rewarded for...
And we sometimes see people we know who are the most raging narcissists do very well. And it's almost layers of reward.
Yeah, that's the thing. It completely rewards you. It's so back to front, because I say the things I say on stage, I would never be rewarded for in a normal job.
So let's talk about Radges.
Oh.
Which I honestly really enjoyed. It was properly laugh out loud fun.
Thanks.
And it's, you say that what, really?
No, I'm always just, by the way, I loved the cast from it, because I was heavily involved in the casting. So it's nothing against the cast or anything. It was just very dark when I wrote it. And then, yeah. then it got turned into this like BBC Three thing.
Oh yeah, it was quite, it had, yeah, I see what you mean. It has a real, there's real kind of guts to it. And then at the same time, it's quite brightly coloured, isn't it?
Very bright, yeah. Yeah. I just wanted to make a Scottish programme where people weren't talking in this weird... There's a big problem with Scottish TV programming where people talk in a really artificial accent. And when we were casting the actresses, they'd come in and talk normally, like me. And then they'd start reading for the part and just have this weird put-on accent. So I just wanted to make something that wasn't like anything I'd seen on Scottish TV before, and I don't know if I achieved that. And I'm writing more scripts now, but I've... And I wanted to set them in Edinburgh, but I think I'll just set them in England because it just feels hard to... I tell a lie, I'm writing something for BBC Scotland, so that'll be in Scotland. But it just feels so difficult. Apart from Lemmy's show, there's like nothing on Scottish TV that I enjoy because none of it feels true to life, so...
And do you feel that the true to life... Did you manage to retain the true to lifeness?
This was the one scene in Raj's... that I remember being identical to how I wrote it. And it was really eerie seeing how accurate it was. There's a scene in the car where the boyfriend starts reading out his writing. That was bang on.
Is this, there's two in the car. Which one was it? There's the one where there's all, every...
No, just, he's just reading to her. I think it's quite early.
It's like
on.
Erotic poetry.
Yeah. That came out pretty much exactly how it was written. Because it's so hard to... make sure your thing stays the same from start to finish. But my script editor was Jono from Sheeps.
Okay.
And he was amazing. And all the stuff that me and Jono fought to have kept in was the stuff people tweeted me saying they liked it. And I had people from, you know, the BBC didn't want, they were like, oh, can we do something in a psych unit because it mocks the mentally ill? And I was like, I am the mentally ill. Also, mentally ill people are hilarious. Like, and also sometimes they can be very tedious. And I feel like I can say that because I've been in one of those units. So it was a real battle to have it set in there. And then since it's been out, I've had people in those units tweet me and say they liked it. So that made me really happy.
And, I mean, I've read some of your writing about being in the psych unit, just for the, for the sake of the listener. Do you want to just flesh out what
right.
that experience
Sorry, to explain.
Was?
So when I was 16, I just stopped going into school because I was really, well, I just went mad and was really depressed and stuff. And then the doctor was like, oh, well, there's this other place you can go to. And then me and my parents took on this visit of this like unit, which was like you go to school there during the day and you have your meals there and you also get therapy and stuff. And I went.
Was it optional? You weren't like sectioned?
I wasn't,
was it?
No, it was voluntary, but it wasn't because my parents made me go.
Okay.
But yeah, they on the day that I went to visit there, I said the word crap. And the nurse went, So I said to my parents, I'm not going in there. It was ridiculous. It's so weird. And all the other people in there were a lot worse off than me. And my mum was like, no, you need to learn discipline. And I was like, it's a psych unit. And then the next thing I knew, I was in there for like 8 weeks and I had a little girlfriend. And there was a lot of lezzing off in the place. There was no therapy. I'd basically just study for my hires, which are like Scottish A-levels, then play pool with my girlfriends. It was like a women's prison, basically. And then we'd go to we were allowed out to the local shopping centre, and then we'd all talk about the ways we planned to kill ourselves and stuff.
Oh my God.
So the original Rajas was very dark.
Yes.
And then the BBC took about a year to be like, hey, how about you take this bit out?
Sure. Did you, when you wrote the original dark version of it, did you think that they would make that?
No, not. I just wrote it for something to do. Like, I wrote it on spec, as you would say. I'll tell you what happened. At the final of So You Think You're Funny in 2011, a woman was like, darling, are you writing any scripts? And I wasn't, but I said yes. So then I had to write a script to keep up with the lie. And then I just wrote it on and off as a hobby. And then 2 or 3 years after that, the producer of Raj's saw me and said, are you writing anything? And I'd seen the comedy feeds before and thought they were shite. Like, so I didn't want to do it. So I had to be sort of persuaded to give him the script. And then I got money for it. And then I just sold my idea to them. So it can never be made again now.
Okay. God. I think one of the things I wanted to ask was about the experience of writing, effectively writing a you character. There's a Fern character.
There is, but...
I mean, not that obviously you appear in that cameo role as the silent girl.
Oh, yeah, that was just so that I could attend rehearsals and control everyone.
It was, that's very smart!
Yeah. Well, that was actually my agent did that, because I was like, I want to attend all rehearsals.
You want to physically be there?
Nice. Yeah, it wasn't because I really wanted to be an actor.
Oh, no, I thought it was a lovely little cameo role. It was really nice to spot you, because you can't tell it's you for one moment.
Well, everyone thinks the main character is me, but it was actually the blonde girl is me.
Ah, okay.
But the way I write is a split. I have like an outgoing version of me and then shy version of me, and then I make that into two characters. But
you've just completely thrown away that sentence, which is... I'm interested in A, that, because that sounds like a really great method to write, and B, why you've kind of gone, oh, I just sort of do it like that.
Oh, well,
like,
so...
that's a good idea, right?
One of them was like, the person is like the one where it's, I wish I'd said all those things, and then the other one's a lot more, that's what I'm like.
And where did you, like, is that an idea that you invented, or did someone suggest to you that's like,
no,
a
I just,
way of doing
it?
And that's
did
a
it.
Really smart way of writing, surely.
Oh, thanks. Well, I just did it because I did it without realising. It was only down the line that I realised. But I make it, the process of making Raj's, and I'm aware how lucky I am that I got a pilot and stuff, but the process of making it sent me actually mad. And I hadn't went mad for a good few years, and I don't take medication anymore. And I went mad in a really embarrassing way at a gig in Southend for Gary Jacket.
Okay.
And I just assumed like people would have heard about it, but probably there's so many mad things happening in comedy. But we like finished filming the pilot, and I'd been up at like 6 a.m. every day. The pilot took 2 years from start to finish, which is absurd for like 17 minutes. And then I finally finished filming it and I'd been doing like 16-hour days. And then I got in a car and went to a gig in Southend, which was a mistake. And I was feeling a bit strange and tired. And prior to this, I'd been doing some things that were a bit odd. Like I dyed my hair pink, which was out of character. And I also started thinking that this tea was almost magical tea that was really good for people. And there was just a few things I was doing that was a bit odd. So I went to Southend and they hated me. But I've done gigs in Essex before, so normally I'm quite resilient with that. And then I walked off stage in Southend and started crying as I was walking off stage. And there was this, basically Adam Bloom had to cradle me in his arms as I sobbed. And then there's this like really lovely but quite gruff man called Kev McCarthy.
I know Kev, yeah.
And he was like, oh, she just had to work on some fucking sitcom and she's really upset. She's had a hard day, mate. And Adam was like, going, Fern, the gig wasn't that bad. And I was like, no, it's not that. And then Gary Jackets was trying to force my money into my hand. And he was like, Fern, you have to get the last train back to London. And I just couldn't stop. I thought I was never going to stop crying. So then I had to walk back. I had to walk back out in front of the audience, holding like a Sainsbury's bag for life. And then they could all just see that I'd been crying and thought I was crying because of them. So then like a hush fell over the audience. So that was humiliating. So then I went to get my train from Southend. But I didn't want anyone to see me crying. So I walked far down the platform and just like sobbed down the phone to my boyfriend. and I cried so hard that the last train to London came and went. So then I was like stuck in Southend. Then my dad had to drive from Milton Keynes to pick me up, and then I cried as soon as I got in the car with him. And I had to go back to the gig in Southend meanwhile in that state. And then my dad was like, why are you upset? And I was like, you don't understand, because you're working class. You just work with trucks. So, yeah. But I got like money for the American thing the other day. And I was like, yes. And I said to my dad, I feel so guilty getting money for nothing. And he went, well, remember the time in Southend?
Yeah.
So, yeah, that was mortifying.
Do you feel powerful or do you feel vulnerable as a comedian when you're on stage?
Sometimes powerful and then vulnerable, generally in Essex and Kent.
Like, yeah. Well, that's I understand that experience. But I mean, generally, like sometimes powerful. Because you, when I said at the beginning of this conversation, one of the things that's so exciting about you is that you don't give a fuck. Like you clearly give a fuck. A lot of things affect you. But at the same time, I think what you have is a really refreshing, like, you don't honour any sacred cows.
Yeah, I mean, that's not... But I don't think that's intentional. Like, I didn't set out to be the comedian that I am, if that makes sense. I think I'm just... Like, a lot of the time when I'm just saying something that I think is normal, people act as if it's outrageous.
Yes.
Which I find quite confusing. So actually quite a lot of it isn't me saying jokes. It's just me being confused and being like, why are you laughing at that?
So do you feel that you've found your voice?
No. Well, the most recent show, I was very happy by the end of it because I felt like I was getting closer to what I wanted to do. Yeah, being more myself. But don't people say your third show is when you find it?
I don't know. I've not heard that. Maybe.
I don't know. I can't, at the moment, I can't imagine writing a third show. But then I said that about a second show. But no, I think once I'm 10 years in, I'll be the most myself that I can be.
How much is that part of the goal for you, to be completely yourself?
Yeah, that's what I want. Because it's really nice. It was really gratifying this year that people came back from last year's show. It's just really nice when... And like, this will sound really lame, but I did a gig in Sheffield recently and people came specifically to see me and I was really happy because I was only like a little gig. I just really like that there's people that empathise with you. Because if you feel like a weirdo and then people connect to your material, it just makes you feel so much better. Whereas if I was trying to second guess myself and doing the material that I thought I should be doing, that would be harder. Because I feel more like a man inside. It's very hard to... This is why it's hard doing the circuit, because you have to battle with what people see of you on stage. And that's why I get tired of being Scottish as well, because I don't know what... I don't believe in, like, Scottishness. So I hate people seeing me as Scottish first and foremost. I don't know if that answer makes sense.
What do you mean by battling what people see on stage? Like, you want to be seen as you rather than any of the sort of signifiers that you...
Yeah. So, because I got into comedy from seeing Brendan Burns and then Doug Stanhope, I've tried to explain this to people a couple of times and it always comes across as if I'm slagging Brendan Burns, and I'm not. I've been to see, like, four of his shows.
Sure.
So, basically, I saw Brendan Burns and he was, like, really... alpha male and bellowing on stage, and I was really excited, but I was also angry and jealous of him because I knew I'll never be like that, because people will see me as a girl when I come on. And that was the case for ages. Like, angry men are praised in comedy, whereas angry women it's not something that we like in society. It's not seen as attractive. And then Doug Stanhope as well has a very male following. Like, I don't hear of many female comedians that want to be like him. So I don't see how I can become like that sort of comedian without having a sex change or something.
Isn't that an opportunity? There isn't already someone doing what it is that you want to do.
Yeah.
Like, that's great, isn't it? That there isn't... there isn't a female Brendan. Not that you should kind of shut it down to being just a female Brendan or a female Stanhope, but like that, like the way that you are angry on stage, the way in which you're angry, the combination that you have of kind of bluntness and brute force, and also you're very articulate.
Oh, thanks.
You know, when you say at the beginning of this conversation, you said, you know, maybe America is the place for me. Part of me, wow, that's really far forward thinking and kind of good. That's an exciting thing to hear. I also feel like you're only 2 hours in over here. You're already getting your audience. Of course there's a place for you here.
I think it's not something that I've thought in a, I'm going to take America away. It's more something I've thought in moments where I'm like, oh, I've been described as Scottish again, as if that's a style of comedy. It's more in moments of frustration that I'm like, oh, I'll just go to America. But then at other times I'm like, shut up, Fern, you've had things, because I got on stuff like 3 years in. So sometimes I get annoyed at myself because I'm like, what have I even got to complain about? Forgot the question.
Last one. Fuck. What are your what do you think are your superpowers as a comedian? What are the strengths that you're kind of like, oh well, that's in the bag, I can definitely do that? I don't mean by including the phrase in the bag, I sort of feel like that's become a trap question. But do you know what I mean? Like, what do you feel are your strongest suits?
Solo shows.
but what within a solo show?
This is really difficult.
When people come back and see you, why are they coming back?
I think they're coming back because they know I'm being myself. I don't know. I think, because my audience are also geeks and weirdos, maybe I think they see a fellow weirdo and it's nice to have that rather than just like, because I find it creepy when like comedians are like, oh, I'm just a lovable everyman, and talking about their wives and that, as if they don't all cheat on them and stuff. I find that sinister. So I find it weird when people say I'm dark, because I'm just being myself. Again, I haven't answered the question. I don't know what my superpowers are. Saying things bluntly, maybe? Yeah. I say things quite bluntly and I'm forthright.
What, if anything, do you think holds you back? What things do you see other comics do that you think, I wish I could do a bit more like that?
I wish I could book my diary better, because I still build it up in my head that a promoter won't want to book me. So I missed out on doing the Vodafone thing in Dublin this year because I was convinced the promoter wouldn't book me. And then I emailed him and he was like, why didn't you get in touch sooner? So that holds me back. It's weird because I think I come across confident on stage, but I'm really not confident off stage. So that's massively held me back in booking my diary. So yeah, I would like to be more motivated.
I often think that. I think that's true of a lot of people. If you could be booking your diary in the persona that you have on stage,
yeah,
you get a lot more done.
Yeah,
I don't mean you specifically, but like, I think that's like, there is often that disparity between, guys, I'm in command of this room,
yeah,
and oh shit, I'm too scared to email anyone.
Yeah, because I don't think it's hard being a woman in comedy, in terms of you do get more TV stuff. Like Finn Taylor was saying, it's hard to get stuff as a white man, and I do see his point. But on the circuit, the sexism that I've experienced, that's what I said in my show this year. It's so similar to stripping. And I've had promoters say things to me where I refuse to get in touch with them now, because I'm like, no, I've done my time as a sex worker. I'm not going to put up with you talking to me like that for no money. Or like I said in my show this year, I used to have middle-aged male comedians telling me I didn't have enough life experience to do comedy and just patronising me, and that really bothered me.
What was the line in the show that really made me laugh?
I'd had it in my head for years and I thought it'll never get a laugh. Just like they'd say, oh, you don't have any life experience, and then I'm like, I've got so much life experience, I stay in the house now with the curtains drawn. And then I'm like, come back to me when you've done your hires in a mental unit and two of your exes have been sectioned and you had a freeway with a policewoman and a beef eater and you've danced for people claiming to be Colonel Gaddafi's relatives and things like that. So yeah, it's just...
But for me, the sting in the tail of that line was that you were being patronised by older middle-class male comics who were saying... You know, you need some life experience like me with my wife and my baby and my kind of cookie cutter life.
Yeah. I try not to do that to younger comics now.
To do what? To tell
To be like, oh, you're too young for this. Although I think I do patronise Elliot still.
Yeah, we all patronise Elliot.
It's just because it's so enjoyable. But yeah, I'm always like wary of that because you never forget people being mean to you when you're in an open spot, I think.
Yeah, true story. I've really enjoyed talking to you. That's what I was going to say. When I first started this podcast and it was briefly mooted that I do an open spot special.
Oh yeah, I was a fan.
Yeah, which I am not doing and have no plans to, so please don't email in because I was absolutely swamped. One of the first emails I got was from you.
Yeah.
As a then open spot. And I remember being really, like, really noticing how pushy you were, but in quite a positive way. I was like, your name really stuck. I thought, she'll go far.
Yeah, I remember you saying that.
Oh, did I say that at the time?
No, you said it to me at something else. Oh,
okay.
I was a very pushy open spot, and I sometimes think I wish I was that pushy now because I'm not. But I think it's because... you just have nothing to lose when you're new. Like, I got my first gig from... I just turned up at the Last Laugh in Sheffield. They wouldn't book me. They were sort of fobbing me off. So I turned up, and then the open spot... His car had broke down, so I got on that way. So I used to just turn up at gigs, and now I'm like, where has that pushiness gone? I'm just so lazy now.
And what do you want, finally, out of comedy?
I just want to like tour solo shows and I mean, I like getting to do bits of telly, but I just want to do stuff so that people want to come and see me do solo shows. Because like I was saying, when I've done little bits of TV, you feel euphoric, but then you feel sad the next day. But the afterglow from having a great solo show just feels really nice and I don't feel bad about it later. So yeah, I just want to do solo shows, and then I also want to finish these scripts that I'm doing, because starting them's easier than finishing them. So yeah,
thanks Fern.
Thank you. That's one of my dreams realized now.
So that was Fern Brady. Thank you to Fern for coming on the show. She texted me afterwards and said, I mean, they really are very strong painkillers that I was on, so sorry for losing focus in the middle of a lot of her answers to the questions. She's absolutely brilliant, and she's really, her act and her whole approach is a real breath of fresh air. It's really, I mean, it might not be that she just don't give a fuck, as I said in that episode, but she really does have a really refreshing lack of giving a fuck. I think that's fair to say. And it's a real joy to watch. So do check out Fern Brady live at Edinburgh or wherever else you might be seeing her. Remember to come along to Redacted Angel Comedy at the Bill Murray this Thursday, the 15th of December at 10:30. And we should all have a lot of top secret fun there. That's everything. Get in touch. info@comedianscomedian.com. If you're a cool guy, put PS I'm a cool guy, which means I can send you an extremely brief reply as I tear through my email. If you fancy donating to the show, it's Christmas, guys. So why don't you donate the same amount of money that you would spend on sponsoring a goat for a loved sibling? What's that? What's that going to be? 12 quid? 18 quid? Something like that? Or you can set a recurring payment of, for example, £2 a month. You can set whatever thing you want. 1 or 2 or 5 or even 10. I think I even put a... Yeah, I did, didn't I? I put a thing up there. I think it's under the heading a super Beowulf. You can donate £100 a month. But that's ludicrous. Don't do that. You can also support the show on Patreon by going to patreon.com/comcompod. And if you're not a PayPal user either, you can do a recurring payment via Moonclerk. But you can find all of those at comedianscomedian.com/donate. And if you like the show, if you want to support it, then the best thing to do is to come up to me in person,
press some cash into my hand, say something cool, and walk off into the distance with a real glint in your eye. The second best thing you can do is chuck me some money online. And the third best thing you can do is to share the show with your friends, subscribe to it in their podcast apps, teach them how to use the technology, and tell people about it. Leave me a nice review on iTunes, particularly if you're listening in America or some other foreign clime, because they're all different iTunes review bases. So if all of my American listeners legged it now to their iTunes account and reviewed the show, favourably I would hope, gave me a nice 5-star review, then that would certainly help me bump up the rankings in the States. And then by the time the Brian Regan one comes out, wallop, maybe that's another little entry point into America. So that's all from me. I will chat to you now if you'd like to stick around for the waffle. And otherwise, that concludes the podcast. I'll speak to you next week. Hello there. Hello. For those of you who've stuck around, thank you. Here are the things. The first thing is, I did an interview with a lady called Jenny Desborough this morning for something she's writing, and I'm sorry, Jenny, I don't remember what, but if you're listening, send me a message, and I'll make sure when it comes out I advertise it, push people towards it. But it was a very good interview. I really enjoyed it. And I was giving, as an example of the way in which little in-jokes amongst the podcast listening community become solidified over time, I was using as an example the fact I never meant to call this bit the waffle. I think I just said, I'll waffle at you, and someone said, oh, I heard that in the waffle one time. Then I started calling it the waffle, and now it's called the waffle. I hate that name. I don't like that name at all. The word waffle is such a sort of, it's like eating food through a beard. Do you know what I mean? It's that horrible kind of, it's just the sound of it, waffle. It's just, ugh. I'm not a fan. So from here on in, it's no longer called the waffle. I don't know what it's called. But maybe we'll call it something else. I mean, it's dangerous. If I open it up to you, you will quite rightly be barracking me and saying, you should call it the sort of boring trailing off into the distance bit that no one listens to. But there we are. I know some of you do, because you send me nice emails about the children's books I should be reading. And that somewhere a listener sent me a link to a book called Granddad's Island, which I already have. And I highly recommend it, but it's bleak. I see if you can happen upon, I see if you can apprehend why it might be bleak. As I describe it to you, these are the terms in which, you know, as you're reading it, you're like, oh, this kid, and he's got a granddad, and they go off to an island together, and the island's really beautiful, and it's a bit like paradise in many ways. And then the kid goes, well, it's time to go now. And I mean, you can see where this is going, right? And granddad says, no, I'm going to stay. You're like, don't stay on the island, granddad. And yeah, I mean, it's a very beautiful thing. And it's very, very painful. I mean, most of the children's books that I read, I'm crying at, because they're so beautiful and they resolve in a narrative way that you just go, oh, the end is buried in the beginning. This is so Aristotelian, this tiny 8-page comic with chewable pages, but it's really well written. And on this occasion, I was crying for a very different reason. So check that out. On the subject of crying, I'm only going to say one little thing about the Boutros now. The Boutros is just over 10 months old, 10 and a bit now, coming up for his first birthday, which is insane. I mean, that can't be the case, obviously. That's not real. That's some sort of weird, demented fantasy land where time marches on. But he's very chatty. Surprise, surprise, we talk to him quite a lot. And he's said a few mum, mum, mums and a few dad, dad, dads. And the other day, he said hello and we burst into tears. Now, what a moment! What a moment when you do hello. He didn't say it apropos of nothing, and he probably doesn't know what he can't know what it means. Surely. So it's not like he greeted us, because I think the moment when your child is sort of around, just sort of in the house, then looks up at you and says, hello, that's like some sort of Westworld-style AI coming online, kind of, hello, father. Whoa, you're in the world now. It sort of suggested that, and we got emotional because of that. But really, he was just sort of repeating the sound. But I thought that was a pretty advanced guy. I'm not saying he's sentient, but he's certainly pretty advanced. That was a really magical time. So it's weird. I'm sort of documenting every so often on the podcast. I talk about him, and I think I've mentioned this possibly before. I've certainly mentioned it to a few friends socially. I sort of thought, hey, I could do some sort of video or audio diary for the boy, and then should something awful and catastrophic happen to me, he said, furiously touching and clutching all the wood around him, then, you know, you do a little video message or whatever for your kid, and you're like, hey, this is, even if nothing catastrophic happens, you think, this is who I was back then. Hey there, Boutros. This is me now. And then, of course, it occurred to me, I've done that in detail over several tens of episodes thus far, and I've made it oddly public. I should probably also do some sort of little private thing for him as well. I think that he might get a kick out of seeing who his dad was as a flouncy 39-year-old. He might not. He might think, well, this is the most awkward and embarrassing thing ever. That's probably more likely. That's probably what I'd think. I don't know. Are you someone whose parent, when they were younger, had access to the technology? I suppose, yeah, when my dad was 40, he must have had access to a video camera. He could have done us a little message and he didn't. Couldn't be bothered. Typical. No, that is not typical at all. If there's one thing my dad is not, it is idle. But, I mean, that'd be quite weird, I think, wouldn't it? To see a parent at the age you are now sending you a message saying, well, this is who I am. I mean, there'd need to be quite an open-ended message, wouldn't it, to not contain an edge of, you'd better be at least as, you'd better be at least as X as I am. I certainly wouldn't approach the Boutros from that angle myself. But you can see now why this, why everyone refers to this as the waffle. Jesus. But I just thought that was rather lovely that he would, that was the first thing he said, hello. And me and his mum looked at each other and went, oh my God, did that just happen? And it was a very magical thing. So if you have been keeping up to date with the occasional Boutros updates, then maybe you'll enjoy hearing that. It was a very magical thing. Finally, I will just quickly talk about the Pappies episode. So this is coming out next week. And Pappies, those of you who don't know, they're a sketch group, a brilliant sketch act, a sketch outfit. And I interviewed them way back in episode 23, if you can remember that far back. They're dear friends of mine, and we've all sort of been going in the comedy world for roughly the same amount of time. And they came on the show on episode 23 and were funny and effusive and intelligent and passionate and all those things. And that was 4 years ago somehow. I mean, that's like four or five Boutrosses ago in real terms. That's an insane measurement of time. No one used that. And they came back on the show, having then had their two series of their TV show, Badults, which was not as well received as I think everybody had hoped. So they talk about that. We really get into detail on that. And we talk about where they're going now. They've had this wonderful Edinburgh show that I think they were having in the year when I first had them on the show. We got a multiple 5-star reviews, and it was sort of the best thing they'd ever done. And, you know, do they plan to go back? What is the plan next? What do you do once you've done that? Once you've achieved all your goals, once you've had your TV series, particularly if you're a duo or a trio as they are, what is the next move? How do you stay together? What happens next? Loads of stuff on that. And a really great episode. We laughed. We almost cried. It was good. And it took place after their own podcast, which I should briefly advertise here, Flat Share Slam Down. And they also do one called Pappy's Bangers and Mash. Both are very funny, both really fun, excellent formats. Flat Slam is a panel game, which the guests were Eleanor Tiernan and Lloyd Langford, both being superb. The show was so fun. And it's like the deal was Christmas special. They do the first half, I do the second half interviewing them. And I got very panicky in the first half of the show because they were just all, everyone on that stage was just taking the roof off in front of an extraordinarily home crowd of Pappy's fans. And I was thinking, oh God, I've got to interview them afterwards. And I get very nervous before the show, before records, as you know, before live podcasts. Far more nervous than I ever get before stand-up gigs these days. And I was really panicky, and I thought it's all about setting the tone. And lo and behold, I walked on stage after and said, "Right, we're gonna do something a bit different now. This is, you know, do you know what the thing is that we're gonna do?" And loads of people cheered, and I went, "Oh, they do actually know what it is. That's good." And what a lovely feeling that was. So I don't know, is that worth including on this? Is that worth saying? I just think it's sort of quite it's a. I don't know how revelatory it is, but yeah, I get bloody nervous before doing podcasts, mostly because I'm terrified that a guest is going to say something, or I'm going to reveal that I haven't done all of the possible research that I could have done in the world. I had to set a little kind of time limit for myself on how much I research people, because it's mostly motivated by interest and also fear. Fear of saying the wrong thing. I mean, nearly 200 episodes in now. And if anything, I'm more nervous than when I started. I kind of recognise the sort of the pre-conversation fear. It's what an odd thing. What an odd thing, particularly for someone in this line of work, having lots of conversations with people. What an odd thing to still feel a sort of social anxiety about a conversation which, let's be honest, is taking place almost entirely on my terms. I mean, that's just nuts. So it was lovely. It all worked out very well. And I think you should very much look forward to that episode next week. I'm very proud of it. I'm proud of this one and also Angela Barnes, who in another... well, you'll hear later, but Angela was someone who I thought about doing a long time ago. And we actually recorded an episode. And then I made the decision, I think, not to put it out because... it was so, her velocity was so extreme. It was so zero to hero, her journey in comedy, that I thought it's just going to frustrate people. Besides, she was so new. I don't think she was in a position really to reflect on her process, as she certainly is now. So funny, Angela. Such a prodigious joke writer. So that one is coming up very soon too. That's enough from me. I'm going to... go and he said hello to me on the phone as well today, just in a kind of a can you say hello to daddy, and then you say hello another seven or eight times, and then he makes some approximation of hello, and then I walk into a lamppost on the other end of the phone. It's just great, guys. Congratulations to friend of the show. Anytime I say guys on an out breath, I always think of Joel Dommett. And congratulations to Joel Dommett for coming second on the celebrity program. I don't watch it. I've never watched it, but obviously I tuned in to see Joel have snakes put on his head, and snakes were indeed put on his head, so it does very much what it says on the tin. But what a lovely person he is, and what a joy to see someone be embraced by the public for not only being ripped and handsome and all of those other Joel things that Joel is, but also just for being such a naturally funny person. So it's not like he needs the extra publicity, but I was very proud to see my friend on telly, and very proud of Brett Goldstein for winning this Best Supporting Actor award, and Davy Johns for winning an award for I, Daniel Blake. What a great time to be alive. Well done, chaps. Good work, everyone. Thank you, Fern. Thank you to Daryl. I keep forgetting to thank Daryl. Hashtag thanks, Daryl. Thanks, Daryl Smith, for editing this show. And also Matt Hoss for logging the episode, and Emily Crosby for nearly logging the episode, but being too busy doing other things for me. What a great lady. Speak to you soon.
Whether you're a morning person or a bedtime procrastinator, everyone deserves a mattress that works for their style. And you'll find the best mattress for you at Ashley. The new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley brings you one-of-a-kind body-conforming technology, making every sleep tailored to be your best. The collection also features cool-to-the-touch covers and motion absorption to help minimize sleep disruptions from partners, pets, or kids. Shop the all-new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley. For the love of home.